Dr. van der Kolk, it seems that trauma is not just physical. It can also have profound physical effects, as if our bodies have their own kinds of memories. Why is there such a strong connection between trauma and our bodies?
Well, we are our bodies. And in our culture, we forget it. We are our bodies, and we are about our bodies, and we are animals. And so if we get scared or we're threatened, we secrete stress hormones to get us out of the way to fight back. And if we are trapped, immobilized, can't do anything, those stress hormones keep pounding your body to run and to move and keep you in a state of great agitation. But that agitation then becomes sort of divorced from the original idea, and your body continues to stay in a constant state of threat.
It sounds like you're saying that the body can react in ways even if we're not consciously aware of what's going on.
Yeah, the body is sort of who we are. Sense of self is sort of an afterthought. We have a little sliver on top of our brain that gives us a notion that we are independent human beings who have our own choices. But in fact, we are big bodies that have an animal brain that needs to be fed and that needs to be taken care of. And so that really runs much of our show, in fact. And when that body feels calm and safe, it allows your mind to do what it needs to do. But if that body feels under threat, it starts hijacking your mind all the time.
So how does trauma affect our senses, how we respond to the world?
Well, trauma causes our senses to become firstly hyper-acute. A lot of traumatized people get very reactive to sounds and lights and touch and various physical stimuli because threats become such a central thing. And then as this goes on, the body sort of desperately tries to calm that down. Many people use drugs, alcohol, stuff like that, to try to do that. Actually, it's probably the single most important cause of drug addiction and alcoholism is a traumatized body that tries to calm itself down. It's a 4,600% increase in incident if you have been abused, let's say, and your chances of becoming a drug addict and an alcoholic. So it's a desperate attempt to calm that body down and somehow gain some sense of control. Many people manage to do that without alcohol or drugs, and they just shut off their relationship to their body. And when that happens, they basically don't feel much in that body anymore. They learn how to ignore all the signals. But if you do that, you ignore signals of pleasure, you ignore signals of engagement, of feeling alive, of feeling connected with people. So one of the effects of trauma maybe is that you go through life feeling like a zombie.
Well, you tell a fascinating story in your book of a patient you call Sherry who was getting a foot massage and
right.
and apparently had some startled reaction when she realized that the therapist had her hands on her feet.
Yeah, it's really very startling to me also to discover the degree to which traumatized people have a very distorted relationship to their bodies. And, you know, most therapists, psychiatrists don't know that because they talk with people about their lives. They don't really investigate what people's physical reactions to themselves is. And then to discover that people feel nothing, that whole parts of their bodies basically are missing, that they don't feel things at all, or they feel too much. And they're hyperreactive in their bodies to stuff that nobody can find an origin of.
How could they not? I mean, if someone is massaging your feet, how could you not feel that?
All you need is to shut down your insula and the perceptual system in your brain, and you don't feel it. So if you get traumatized enough and you're sort of assaulted by too many sensations that are overwhelming, your brain goes back to a state of trying to feel in control and feel safe, and your brain just learns how to shut down those sensations. But with that, you shut down sensations for anything, basically.
So there are certain parts of the brain then get shut down in response to trauma.
Right. And so all these strange reactions start off as ways in which people try to defend themselves and deal with the horror that's happening to them. And so they have their origin in the organism trying to be helpful in one's survival. But if it continues, then it makes you very ill-equipped to deal with daily life. Because you may have shut yourself down so you don't feel anything, but it means that as you walk through the street and you meet somebody, you also don't feel anything. Or you learn to not notice certain things, which may be very helpful in the middle of an assault. But if that happens on a daily basis, people will see you as a space cadet. Or you may be, and this is very much what happens with soldiers, for example, is that your brain gets reorganized to deal with threat. And we have very good data that the brain changes, so you become very alert to threat, but you become very oblivious to anything else. So it becomes very hard to function under ordinary situations because your brain has changed in order to deal with danger, but there is no danger. You sort of go offline and you're not quite there.
Can you give me an example of that, maybe of someone you have seen in a clinical setting?
Yeah, this is something we see a lot. You see it in veterans coming home, and they were very good soldiers, and they play with their kids, but they can't feel anything for their kids. Or they have a hard time connecting with their loved ones because they sort of feel dead inside. And then when they start talking about what happened to them in Afghanistan and Iraq, they start feeling alive again. And they may hate it, but they still feel alive at the same time.
Wow.
But the ordinary, everyday things that really ought to give us pleasure and satisfaction, the perception of that is sort of very numbed out, very dulled out.
Which I suppose helps explain then why some of these people go back into war. I mean, that's the one place where they will feel alive again.
Yeah, and so you get this strange paradox, which people have called and have adopted a term, the pain of pleasure and the pleasure of pain, is that at some point nothing means anything to you, but the very thing that has caused you pain also makes you feel alive. And so the only sense that you get, place you get a sense of meaning is the same thing that hurts you so much and that causes so much misery.
So what do you do?
And so the people get really trapped in that in a terrible way.
Yeah. So what do you do when you see people like this who come in to see you looking for help?
Well, I think most of all, you need to wake yourself up to the present. And that is primarily not so much going to revisit the past, but learning to be alive in the present. And in some ways, I think what the U.S. Marine Corps does with their adolescent recruits who are still pretty immature people is a very good model, actually. They very intensely expose people to situations that make them feel very alive. They may be somewhat dangerous, but they climb things, they move things. So helping people to feel alive in the present is extremely important. And again, since so much of this is in the body, it is very useful to do things that make people feel alive in the present in their bodies, like singing, moving, doing theater with people. We do a lot of yoga. I think martial arts might be helpful. Anything that makes your body feel alive right now, but that's not connected with the trauma per se, so you don't reactivate all the same old circuits again. So you need to really open up the mind and the brain and the body to get a deep sense of pleasure and feeling alive in the present, in the moment.
Are you saying these kinds of physical activities actually rewire the brain so that it activates those pleasure centers again?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've also done a lot of work with EMDR, eye movement desensitization, and reprocessing. Could you explain how that works?
Well, I can, but I think it may be a little complex on a radio show. But basically, very strange technique. Everybody who hears about it raises an eyebrow. About 25 years ago, Francine Shapiro discovered that if you move your eyes back and forth while you think about a very bad event, that event sort of calms itself down. And that eventually became EMDR, and it became a technique that's been studied, learned now by about 100,000 people around the world. And actually, I did some National Institute of Health funded research on that method, being quite skeptical about it initially. And we had fantastic results, actually.
Wait, you'll have to explain this. Just moving your eyes back and forth as you're thinking about this traumatic thing that happened?
As you are, call up the memories, the what you saw, what you heard, what you smelled, what you felt in your body, what you were thinking. And when you do that and you move your eyes from side to side, then something starts shifting. And what it looks like happens here is it's very similar to what happens when you dream, when you also move your eyes back and forth. And at that time, the brain probably uses these pieces, these fragments, to create schemes of what the world is about. It sort of consolidates memories and attaches us to other things that's happened in your life. So what it looks like happens here is that when you get traumatized, a number of different brain circuits and brain regions that you need to put an event behind you go offline. And so, because when you're so hyper-aroused and terrified in a state of horror, that capacity of the brain to integrate the event, and when it's over, to be able to say, it's over, you know, it was really awful, but now I'm back with my family, I'm back home, and I'm okay, that capacity is interfered with because certain parts of the brain have gone away at the time of the horror. So what one needs to do is to help people to go back to the event, but at a time that those brain areas that you need to integrate it and to help you to put it in the past are present. And it seems like EMDR is one method by which you can bring those brain regions online that you need in order to make a differentiation between things happening now and things having happened a long time ago.
That's remarkable. It sounds like what you're saying.
It is remarkable.
It sounds like you're saying that by doing this, you are kind of draining the emotion out of those memories. I mean, it's not as if you're erasing the memories, but you're sort of turning them into normal memories again.
You're turning them into, and that's what we see and that we can document actually in our research, is that before we do these things, people see it, they hear it, they feel it in their bodies, they're very overwhelmed by it. And after it's over, they say, yeah, this is what happened. And it happened back then on March 3rd, 1948 or whenever. And I was a little kid, and now it is September 2014, and I'm a different person now.
Wait, are you saying just after one session of EMDR this can happen?
No. This, you know, it depends on many different things. The more acute the trauma is, the more efficiently this worked. For example, a number of my colleagues, not myself, but saw not too long ago a number of people who were affected by the Boston Marathon. And within one or two sessions, just it became like, boy, I went through a really bad experience, but I'm safe now. And it was very simple. And my colleagues, my supervisees, say, they couldn't believe their eyes almost, how people just say, okay, it happened. That was my experience, but it's over now. And I see this in my office quite a bit. It's a very gratifying thing to see when you're a therapist. You see people just come to life and say, hey, I'm alive. Thank you very much. They shake your hand and walk out. Okay. But you know,
it's a little hard to believe.
It's a little bit hard to believe, and it's almost too good to be true. But this is what we see in acute trauma quite a bit. If, you know, people have been in the war for four different rotations, it isn't so simple. And it takes a much longer period of time to go through it. But the results at the end, if you're patient and you do it, can very much be like that, that people say, I'm back here, I'm back home now. And that's really what we're aiming for when we treat people, is to say, I'm alive right now.
If I were to come into your office and I would get this EMDR treatment, what would you do? How would you do that with me sitting right there?
I would, first of all, I would want to get to know you a little bit so we feel somewhat comfortable with each other. And then I'd say, become very quiet and just say, just sit in your chair and evoke the scene of what happened back then. And I don't ask you to talk about it, because the moment you start talking about it, you start reliving it. And one of the great problems with verbal therapy is that the moment you start talking about these terrible things, your body tends to get hijacked and to feel like it's happening all over again. So one of the important things here is to be very quiet and to say, just notice in your mind what happened back then. What did you see? You don't have to tell me it. What did you hear? What were you thinking at the time? And then you ask people to go into these eye movements. My hunch is that in hypnosis you can do the same thing, but very few people are doing hypnosis anymore these days. It used to be the treatment of choice during the Second World War and until about 1990, but then that sort of disappeared from what people learn. But you go into sort of a trance state, and in the trance state you can sort of rework that memory, and it becomes a memory. Because a trauma, people talk about traumatic memory, but it's not really a memory, it's a reliving. Every time you go there, it feels like it's happening again. And so the job of overcoming trauma is to actually make it into a memory. And to say, yeah, I was in Afghanistan, I saw that horrible thing, and that happened on that day at that time. But, you know, it was very bad, but now it's over.
Have you tried EMDR yourself?
I've tried everything I do. So I do, in my book I describe many different methods, EMDR. I'm a great fan, advocate, researcher of yoga. Yoga is a great way of helping people to get in touch with their body, feeling alive in their body, regulate their physiological arousal. And I just published a research study that showed that in our particular population, people were at a better response to yoga than on any pharmacological drug that had ever been studied. And I had done quite a few of the drug studies myself, so I could compare the two.
Wait, so you're saying, for instance, yoga is more effective dealing with trauma than say, antidepressants like Prozac or Zoloft?
Yeah, that's what our research seems to indicate. And it doesn't mean that everybody who is taking Zoloft or Prozac should immediately move to yoga and then you can get rid of your antidepressants. But in terms of the figures we found in our research is that yoga had a larger, had a greater effect on people's PTSD symptoms than any drug study that any of us has ever done.
Any particular kind of yoga?
I have some questions about it. We do a particular kind of yoga in our clinic that is very much geared towards people who are victims of chronic child abuse and people who tend to be very scared. So we call it gentle yoga. And my colleague Dave Emerson actually wrote a book about it and we train people in it. But I think there's probably various forms of yoga that might be helpful for different people. For example, my hunch is, although I'd love to research that because you can't really say those things unless you have hard data on that. My hunch is that warriors who come back might do much better with hard yoga, where they get to feel strength and aggression in their body and feel like it's okay to feel strong and it's okay to feel aggressive because I can contain it. So my hunch is that different populations would need a slightly different form of yoga. But the yoga that we do in our center is very gentle yoga, and we have a protocol for that.
Are these kinds of practices, whether we're talking about yoga or EMDR, are they good for everyone? I mean, I assume this goes beyond just people suffering from PTSD.
Well, you know, if you don't have PTSD, I see no reason to do EMDR. But yoga, like I'm a regular yoga practitioner, and I think I'm a better person for doing it. I think I'm quieter, more mindful, more tolerant, more thoughtful in my disagreements with people, stuff like that. It's very interesting that, you know, I think the whole culture is doing that, what has happened to me also. We start off in a Western tradition. The Western tradition is yakking and drugs.
Well, the Western tradition has sort of cut the mind off from the body, right?
Right, right. But it's also, but there's also a deep belief that as long as you can talk, things will get better. And you know, talking can be enormously important, and I'm not, actually one of my better chapters in my book is about what language can and cannot do. I love that chapter. But the Western tradition is not to go deep inside and to get to know yourself very well on a visceral level. And then it's very interesting to go to China and India and Japan and to see that they have long traditions of doing Qigong, Tai Chi, yoga, which is very much about helping you to relate to your body. And it's very clear to me that those methods were all invented in those cultures to help people with trauma. And because they figured out another dimension of the whole trauma thing, which is people's dysregulated and out-of-control bodily sensations. And it's very interesting, actually, when you go to those places today, because everybody wants to be like America, that they're giving up this old methods, which I think are very good, and adopting Western methods of drugs and yakking, until these methods are re-imported into California. And once people in California do it, it's okay for people in China and India too.
I have to say, it's kind of amusing to hear a psychiatrist talking about the limits of yakking, of talk therapy, for instance.
Well, of course, there's much more extreme people in my profession who believe that you should only give people drugs. No, I think talking is important, but most importantly, befriending yourself, allowing yourself to feel what you feel, and becoming safe in your body is the most important thing in overcoming trauma. That involves many things that is not part of traditional psychiatry. For example, we don't touch. And I don't touch either. But I think as long as your body cannot tolerate having another person touch you, you are not in good shape. I think it's very difficult to feel alive and a part of the human race as long as your skin cannot tolerate another person's body. And so working with the body is a very important part of healing trauma.
Yeah,
and you know, I refer all of my patients to a group of Feldenkrais practitioners and cranial sacral people who can actually help people to feel comfortable with their own bodies and to be touched.
Why do these particular practices help? What do they do?
They help you to feel safe in your body. It makes it feel make people feel safe to have sensations, to have a body. There's another interesting thing here, is that in the culture, people talk about trauma as an event that happened a long time ago. But in fact, that is not what the trauma is, because that event is over. What the trauma is the imprints that that event has left on your mind and in your sensations. So trauma is really what is happening right now in terms of what you feel and the discomfort you feel and the agitation you feel and the rage and the helplessness that is happening right now. And so it's all located in the landscape of your body. And in order to lay these things to rest, you have to learn to reorganize your relationship to the sensations inside.
I want to come back to what you mentioned earlier, sort of what talking can and cannot do. So what specifically can talking not do?
Well, let me first say what talking can do. A lot of trauma is about things that are secret or that you're not allowed to talk about or that are dangerous to talk about. Like if you're an incest victim, you cannot tell people that you're being molested. If you're a victim of a Catholic priest, child abuse person, I've seen many people like that, you could not tell people that a priest was molesting you because you would always be extruded from the community for revealing an awful truth. If you have been a soldier and you have committed atrocities, which many of them have, it is just too painful to confess what you have done. And so a lot of trauma is about secrets that you don't want to know and don't want anybody else to know. And so finally being able to say honestly what has happened to you and have somebody sit there in a judgmental way and say...
In a non-judgmental way.
In a very much, very important non-judgmental way. Say, oh my God, that must have been so painful. Or how did you deal with that? Oh my God, how did you survive that? Huh? And if you can really find words for internal experience, enormously important, enormously powerful. So that's what words can do. It's to bring secrets out in the open. But that's about limitations of words, because once it's out in the open, it's okay to talk about it, then words are not going to do the rest of the job of changing one's relationship to oneself. So it's an important dimension of the whole thing, but it's not the whole thing.
Right. Right. I want to come back to what we were talking about earlier about EMDR. I understand that you are now trying to study how the brain's affected by EMDR by putting people into fMRI scanners. Is that true?
Yeah, we're doing that right now. Yeah.
What are you finding?
I don't know yet. I just got a phone call from I'm right now traveling, and actually the research is being done with a colleague in Canada, and she just called me yesterday and said, hey, I want to talk to you about what you're finding. So I don't know what you're finding yet. I have some ideas what we should be finding, but you make hypotheses and we'll see if they work out.
Yeah. So all this that we've been talking about, I mean, using the body to heal trauma, whether it's EMDR or yoga or, you know, these other kinds of bodily
or
practices.
Or theater, for example.
Is this widely accepted among professionals, psychiatrists and therapists?
Depends on who you talk to, you know. Whenever I talk, about 300 to 500 people show up and they all say, boy, this is so cool and I'm doing some of this. So I think it's a very interesting thing. These things are widespread, understood and practiced in the community. But it's not what's being taught in graduate schools, medical schools, etc., in part because we have this big disparity between what insurance companies pay for, and of course people need to make a living, and what actually works. And so many of the things that actually work are not reimbursed by the insurance companies.
Why wouldn't insurance companies pay for this?
Because I think they're not aware yet that the things that they're paying for the wrong things much of the time. I hope my book will make some difference in that. Yeah. But it sort of would be odd for an insurance company to pay for a theater director to teach kids how to play Shakespeare, for example.
Right.
Which probably is very good treatment, actually. what is most puzzling to me is another thing that I do practice and research is something called neurofeedback, which has been around for quite a long time. It's finally, I think it's getting finally approved for treatment of ADHD. And so you can play computer games with your own brainwaves. And you can teach your own brainwaves to reorganize themselves. So you can have a fair amount of control over the attentional systems in your own brain by using instruments that help you to sort of retrain your focus and attention system. I'm just writing up the results of a very carefully done study. And it's a very good treatment for PTSD. Not so much for PTSD. It's a very good treatment for being disorganized, unfocused, overwhelmed, and being unable to think clearly. And so neurofeedback can be very helpful to get people to be still enough, quiet enough, focused enough to begin to develop a narrative or a plan for their lives. Hmm. And so for me, it's a very core foundation for beginning to do the work in the most disorganized and most overwhelmed people.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me that insurance companies don't reimburse it. And because insurance companies don't reimburse it, It's very hard to do it, and only people who are independently somewhat prosperous can afford to pay for it on an individual basis. And that's something that I'm very hopeful that my work will change that, and that people will really see through the scientific work that we do that neurofeedback can actually change people who could not be changed before.
Hmm. We've been talking about the edges of our senses, and I've heard that some EMDR therapists don't just use visual cues. They also do things like they tap on your body. They use auditory stimulation.
Yeah.
How do these things work?
I don't know. And you know, there's limits to what one person can sort of encompass and understand and work on. And so I tend to focus on stuff that I can do and then also take into the lab and investigate. And then I leave it up to other people to do what they do. So I happen not to tap on people's legs, let's say. You know, if somebody does it, fine with me. But then it's up to them to find out how it works.
It sounds like what you're saying is that we're still only just beginning to learn how to deal with people who've had serious trauma. I mean, this is a field, a scientific field, a medical field that is still opening up.
Absolutely. It's a very young field. You know, I like to think that I was very much present at the beginning. And when I started to do this work with Vietnam veterans, there was no diagnosis PTSD. We knew nothing. And then later on, they discovered that 100 years before, people were in the same situation, and that from time to time, people learned about trauma, like in the First World War and in the 1880s and Second World War. And then very quickly, people forget this. And so, yes, we are both a very old and a very young field. And it's a new field. It's very complex. What's different today is that we know how widespread trauma is, and we didn't know that before. And I think the general public still thinks that trauma is about returning soldiers. But in fact, more people have been killed by their domestic partners than soldiers have been killed in Iraq or Afghanistan. And more kids die of gunshot wounds at home than die of leukemia. And so trauma is widespread in our society and leaves very long-lasting traces in people's lives.
I have to say, this is just remarkable and fascinating work. Thank you for talking about it.